Biological Farming Roundtable podcast helps farmers explore innovative, low-input, regenerative and profitable farming systems. The Biological Farming Roundtable is sponsored by Nutrisoil, an award-winning biological liquid fertiliser made from a big worm farm. Nutrisoil's purpose is to empower farmers to produce life-enriching food. My name is Nicola Maddock. I work at Nutrisoil. I envisage a future where farmers are rewarded for producing nutrient-rich foods and consumers have this easily available to them.
Today we're here with Blake Vince, a regenerative farmer from Canada who produces corn, soybeans and winter wheat. Blake is a Nuffield scholar, a cover crop specialist and a pioneer of no-till practices. I was fortunate enough to see Blake present recently in Australia at the Vic No-Till Annual Conference. So, Blake, thanks so much for chatting with me today. I understand you've made some significant changes in the way you think and practice farming. Could you give us a brief rundown of your journey?
Sure. So, I'm fortunate enough that we started no-till here on our farm in 1983. Mm-hmm. And when I came over to university in 95, we were still doing no-till quite aggressively and maintaining that course of direction. And I decided in 2008, I believe, that we should, or 2006 rather, that we should look at doing some strip tillage because that was the rage, where we could have placed fertilizer specifically in a zone, and then plant our corn on top of that. Yeah. So we did that until 2013, and that time we decided to abandon that practice, and I had sold my strip till machine. And now today we're using multi-species cover crops in lieu of any tillage whatsoever to try and remediate soil and really enhance the biological activity of the soil. Those are some of the key things that we've done here on our farm, is that we've really gotten back to the principles of no tillage in conjunction with living roots and trying to maintain the energy of the sun with photosynthesis.
Yeah. What was your key driver for change, do you think?
Well, I think my key driver for change has been just based on the fact that I've been able to meet some unique people around the world, one of those being David Brandt from Carroll, Ohio, who happens to be a very good friend and mentor of mine. And David, actually, I had the chance encounter of meeting him at a field day in Ohio, and he was in the soil pit, and he looked at me when I was there sort of supporting that tillage machine that I owned, and he said, "Son, I want to tell you something, that I can do way more with roots than you can with that machine right there." And David, you know, being the gentleman that he is, he took me back to his farm and we walked across the cornfield, and I can remember that year that his physical yield that he produced was exactly the same as I did that fall at harvest, with the exception being that David had used half the nitrogen fertilizer to produce the same physical outcome. And so right away it dawned on me that David was the one making the money. He wasn't using as much diesel fuel, obviously, for tillage. He didn't have the depreciation that I had. He didn't have the expense in additional nitrogen fertilizer that I was using. And so right then and there, I realized that I had to look at this system a little more closely, because at the end of the day, the only thing that I can control in my business is my cost of production. And so that has a direct impact on the bottom line. And I thank David Brandt for taking the opportunity to make me think differently.
Do you have any key principles that guide your decision-making, do you think?
So our key principles here that guide us on our farm, and I work alongside my father, Elwin, and my uncle Tom Vince today, and our goal on our farming operation is that we leave our soil in better condition for future generations. And I hear that said quite a lot around the world, but the difference with us, I believe, is we do that regardless if the future generation happens to be our children or somebody else's children that own this piece of property one day.
Yeah.
So we want to leave this soil that we have better so that the next farmer, whoever they may be, can take it and still be successful producing food.
Yep. Beautiful. All right. Do you set yourself goals to achieve ever?
Generally, I set myself goals. My goals are to obviously remain in business on an annual basis. I think that's paramount. My other goal is to try and be in a position to be able to grow.
Yeah.
Not only grow crops, but grow our business. So I want to be financially viable, that if opportunities present themselves to buy land, or if I have to go out and buy buy additional storage facilities for grain if the yield keeps going up like it has been, that I'm not afraid to do that. And so those are sort of our goals or our benchmarks that, you know, we're still trying to grow on an annual basis. I guess that's sort of it in itself. You know, I'd like, my goal is that I would like this business to be viable, that at the end of the day, perhaps my children would see it as an opportunity to come home and work alongside me.
How do you measure progress? You often do trials or?
So how do we measure progress? That's a great question. So on an annual basis, we're always evaluating products, new products, specifically seed. And so we'll take our practices that we've implemented here by planting our corn and our soybeans into cover crops, green living cover crops, and we'll evaluate them on an annual basis and how they perform for physical tons of grain harvested per hectare, or in North America, bushels per acre. And so we'll use that, those tools on an annual basis to determine what hybrids or what soybean varieties will work best in our environment. And that's critical that we do our own on-farm research with our own soil, because products, as we all know in agriculture, perform vastly different across different soil types, different environments. And so I think it's critical that the farmer invest his own time and energy with his own machinery and his own skill set to make sure that he does indeed have the right products for his field and what his production practices are.
What type of input changes have you made in your fertilizer and insecticide applications?
Well, there's the biggest changes that we've made here start with the production of corn specifically, and that we used to use anhydrous ammonia a lot for our nitrogen needs, and now we've gone to a 28% nitrogen solution for side dressing corn when we have to put nitrogen out there at that time of the year. The other thing that we have done, too, I'm really watching a lot on the salt index of various fertilizer types. So here in Canada, we have used MAP for quite a few years, but I know in various geographies around the world, DAP for phosphorus demand is still quite common. But we prefer to use MAP, as well as we're using sulfate of potash as opposed to muriate of potash. So we'll also get the sulfur benefit, and we have a lot less salt in that product than muriate of potash. The other thing is seed now today. It's quite difficult to find seed that isn't bundled with a fungicide and insecticide seed treatment. And we've actually gone to the polar opposite, where we used to have seed that we would buy on an annual basis that had insecticide and fungicide seed dressings. Yeah. And now we're actually planting corn and soybeans with absolutely no seed treatment whatsoever. And surprisingly, our stands are better than with full seed treatment.
Yeah, right. And what do you think the reason is? What we're trying to achieve?
Well, what we're trying to achieve is that the first thing that that seed needs to do upon germination is colonize with fungi. And so if we have a fungicide on there, obviously there's going to be an impact. And so what we've set out to be a net benefit for the seed at times is a net detriment. And the other thing is, too, we have seen the impact of things like slugs has really increased dramatically when we start using all these insecticide seed treatments, because we're killing beneficial insects like carabid beetles that actually are predators on slugs. But when we have insecticide-based seed dressing, then they kill those beneficial insects, and it allows a pest, a mollusk, which isn't an insect, a slug, it allows those populations to explode. So that's sort of what's motivated us to try and get away from insecticide seed dressing.
Okay. Can you tell me, and our listeners, how you sow a cash crop into your multi-species crops?
Aside from the normal practice, we rely a lot here on GPS. So I'm fortunate enough that I own my own RTK base station, because when you have a conventional style of a planter and you put this into this into an environment with a traditional row marker, it's quite easily lost with all this high residue. But normally the planter performs actually far superior in this green environment than in dry, brittle residue. There's far less hairpinning in the seed trench because the plant material is succulent, and a sharp double disc opener or a single disc opener will cut right through that living green plant material quite easily. And so we've actually eliminated coulters on our planter, and our planter is set up much like a conventional planter would be if you were planting into tilled soil. And so other than heavy-duty down-pressure springs on the parallel arms, our planter is pretty much equipped for conventional tillage. And it's kind of unique in that most people think, oh, you need all of these attachments on the planter in order to plant through this green living residue, and it's actually the opposite. And we have experimented with different style of closing wheels to close the seed furrow. And at times, that's what the biggest challenge is that the seed furrow looks a lot like that you've planted in a wet condition, when really it's the collection of living roots that at times prevents the seed furrow from being closed shut again. And so we played around with some notch closing furrow or notch closing wheels, and that has helped. But we're working on perfecting that part of the planting situation right now.
You're so green. What about, you've spoken to me previously and at your presentations about your reduction in glyphosate use and how you use that when you're sowing that cash crop in.
So we're really emphasizing here the limited use of glyphosate. And the reason we're doing that is we want, it's not that I'm anti-glyphosate, but I want that technology to be available for a long time. And also what we're seeing is when we plant green and we use glyphosate as a desiccant, we're seeing that the glyphosate is ending up in the seed zone. And so when those new seedlings emerge, the first order of business is they try and colonize with mycorrhizal fungi. And what we're seeing, or what we've observed, is that these seeds are having a hard time colonizing with mycorrhizal fungi, and that it really limits their growth and development at the early stages of their life, and especially if they're challenged for water. So in a limited rainfall year, then that problem is compounded, because the plant needs to be able to go out and scavenge with the use of mycorrhizal fungi, which are impossible to see with the human eye. But the fungi is what brings in both nutrients and water to the seedling. And so if that plant is compromised, that relationship rather is compromised, then that seedling appears deficient, and it is delayed in its growth until you get sufficient rain for it to sort of rinse off the roots and allow it to recolonize.
So do you wait for moisture for the time for sowing, or do you wait for rain? Because what you're explaining is that you delay your glyphosate application until your seed has had an opportunity to germinate. So could you explain a little bit how you manage that?
So what we try to do is we try to look at weather forecasting models of what is anticipated. If it's going to be a dry spring, then we need to change our strategies. We need to be out there and not let the cover crop get too big, because as we accumulate more above ground biomass, we accumulate more below ground biomass. We might need to terminate the crop earlier. I would prefer, you know, and farming is always a give and take. Agriculture is always a give and take. And so my preferred methodology may be very well to plant green, but if it doesn't look like that's going to be the best strategy based on the cards that I'm going to be dealt with weather, then I need to make an alternative exit strategy. And I might need to terminate earlier. The problem is that when we terminate earlier or prior to planting, then we lend ourselves to having more difficulty planting, more hairpinning in the seed trench. We also, the minute that we terminate the plant and it stops growing, and if for whatever reason we were to experience a big deluge of a rain event, because I live in this Great Lakes region, which at that time of the year isn't uncommon, and I'm on heavy clay soil, if I have an abundance of biomass above ground and I get it coupled with a big rain event, then it will never dry out under there. So I'm better off to leave the roots living for as long as possible and then plant through them and desiccate afterward.
Yeah.
And I'll have far greater success than trying to burn it off in advance and then try to plant, especially if I was to couple that with a big rain event.
Mm.
So what we're trying to look at is we're looking at alternative herbicides other than glyphosate as our desiccant.
Mm.
And also coupling that with the use of technologies like a roller crimper
mm-hmm.
to try and roll the residue down on the surface and kill it or terminate it with a mechanical crimp. And that has worked as well, but to say we're going to be 100% effective, that's not always going to be the case. So we're still going to use herbicides as part of our toolbox.
So while your costs have reduced, Blake, have there been any increases in your profit margins?
Yeah, so the profit margin has definitely increased, and that's because we're keeping more of a vigilant eye on the bottom line in that we're controlling our inputs. We're not caught up in the fact of buying all the latest and greatest technology in the ways of seed or fungicide to spray over the top just to try and capture a few extra bushels or tons of grain. Our goal in order to remain profitable is to try and do the most with the least. And sadly, though, the industry has us as farmers on a perpetual spend.
Yeah.
And they try and get farmers engaged by buying the latest and greatest technology. And and we're trying to do the opposite. And it has to make financial sense in order for us to try and participate before before buying any sort of input.
Yeah. How do you feel about being in the same market as the high input users? Do you see any future in premium prices at all?
Well, presently, you know, it would be nice to be paid a premium for my effort. There's no doubt about it, because I think what I'm doing is has a definite benefit for everybody around me as far as water quality, for sure. Of the water that leaves our farm, I believe, is a lot better than most people that do a lot of excessive tillage, for sure. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I believe we're doing is we're capturing carbon. We're taking CO2 out of the atmosphere and we're driving carbon down into the soil. So there are carbon payment schemes that are starting to pop up in areas of across Canada.
Yeah.
Sadly, though, they're very regional in nature, and those aren't available for farmers like myself where I live presently. But I'm anxiously sitting on the sidelines saying, I hope this comes to fruition, because I do believe that I should be eligible for any sort of carbon payment that my practice is would entitle me to.
Would be nice.
Absolutely.
You talked about water quality. I noticed on Twitter and in your presentation, you have concerns about agriculture's input on the Lake Erie algal bloom.
Yes.
Do you want to share your thoughts about that?
So presently in Lake Erie, why I'm so passionate about that, and that's really the ongoing problems with Lake Erie and the algae blooms, is what motivated me to apply for my Nuffield scholarship.
Right.
Because our water for my house that feeds my wife, my two kids, and myself comes from Lake Erie via a municipal water line. And so I want to make sure that that water that comes into our house is as healthy as it can be. And what I see is a lot of farmers here have reverted away from no-till. No-till in southwestern Ontario, where I live in Canada, the most southerly part of Canada, really started to take off in the early 80s. And into the 90s. And then when farming price of commodities started to get stronger into the mid-2000s, 2012, 2013 specifically, after the big drought in 2012 in the U.S., a lot of farmers reverted away from no-till back to full-surface tillage to try and capture a few extra bushels.
Yeah.
But what we're finding now, too, is that coupled with larger landscapes at the farm level, like more acres per farmer, that the efficiency curve of the method of applying fertilizer with big carrageators, bulk spreaders, and then tillage has really caused a lot more erosion And they try to blame it on no-till, but that's not necessarily the case. If you overlay no-till and the upswing in conventional tillage, and with these algae blooms specifically, we really start to see that farmers are having an impact on water quality, and it happens in a multitude. It's not just going to happen instantaneously, but over time, a collection of more and more people reverting back to tillage creates more of a larger impact on the environment as a whole. Sadly, though, farmers aren't the only culprit to this problem, because we see land usages, even based on simple homeowners, with cosmetic use of fertilizer on their lawn and golf courses and playing fields. These also have impact, as well as wastewater treatment facilities, that when there's a big rain event and the wastewater treatment facility that is human impact, they can't keep up. Well, there's a certain amount of bypass that takes place into the adjacent river and ultimately out to the lake. And so the impact isn't just at the farm level, but the farmers are going to get vilified because they represent the largest percentage of land ownership. And so if, as a farmer, my motivation is I would rather be seen as being part of the solution than being accused as being the problem. And when it comes down to the fact that that water comes to feed myself and my wife, my kids, like I said earlier, I want to make sure that I'm doing everything in my power to ensure that that is the case.
So your personal values, do you think that they're aligned with your farming system, or do you think that you're working at odds with them before you changed your system?
I think my personal values have changed as I've matured. You know, when I came home from university as any young bloke, you know, it's all about damn the torpedoes, get out of my way. We're gonna set the world on fire. We're gonna produce as much as possible. You know, we're gonna see how much milk this cow can make. You know, how many liters can she produce? And now as I've got older, I've become more in tune with my environment. And I'm thinking, well, is that not only financially viable, but is it environmentally viable? And I'm more in tune with, or I get more greater satisfaction by, looking at the impact that we're having, like with water quality, like I mentioned earlier, with other sort of species of birds sort of returning to the landscape, other flora and fauna, like native animals that you start to see that sort of come back here as well. And I guess as I get older and I get more sensitive, I've tended to gravitate more to the softer side of my career than worrying about production at all costs. You know, I think that's a bit of a maturity thing, and being more content as I've become not as concerned with every ounce of production. You know, I've realized that there's a greater role to play here on the farm.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Blake, if you could imagine your farm and yourself to be the most spectacular version that you could possibly be and your farm could be, what would that look like to you?
That's a very difficult question. Anytime you're talking about yourself, you know, obviously I wish I was more resilient and less offended by what people think of my practices and what I'm trying to do. You know, people are at times venomous, and they're quick to tear you down when you're trying to do things that are new or different to agriculture in this profession that's, you know, a learned profession. Grandpa did it this way, Dad did it this way, and that's why I do it this way. And when you change from that, you know, it's not welcome, because then if you're successful, other people need to contemplate change, and nobody likes that. And so if I'm successful, that automatically means perhaps that what they're doing isn't right. So then they have to contemplate change, because I might be making more money than they are. And if they're not one to wanting to do change, well, then it's easier for them to condemn me than to say, hey, you're doing a good job. I appreciate what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
And so when they're not supportive, that sort of, you know, cuts a bit to the quick, as it were. And sometimes I find that kind of offensive. So the other thing, you know, I'm very fortunate, and I take great pride in the fact that how my crop appears. And I think as farmers in general, we all pride ourselves in having that nice outward appearance of our crop and that it looks to be the best crop it can possibly be.
Mm-hmm.
But what we don't share necessarily is, was it the most profitable crop?
Yeah.
Okay, so it can be the best aesthetically pleasing crop in the neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
but if it doesn't make us any money, right, as a farmer, mm-hmm. that's not very good, because soon we won't be in business anymore.
Yeah.
So I've realized that, and that comes down to, like, I like things to look nice, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But if it's not going to make me money, then I'm not too concerned. I'm not as concerned about it as I once was.
Yeah.
I'm not, because I don't get paid in my business. I'm not in the cosmetic business. I don't get paid for aesthetics.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm concentrating on profitability, not necessarily on just making everybody that drives by happy by the way it looks to their eye.
Yeah, brilliant.
Please follow the Biological Farming Roundtable podcast. Share it with your friends and networks. I'm Nicola Maddick and I work at Nutrisoil, a liquid biological fertilizer made from a big worm farm whose purpose is to empower farmers to produce life-enriching food.